From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. After removing National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster and announcing it on Twitter last night, President Trump sent out another bombshell tweet this morning, taking aim at the trillion-dollar budget deal that Congress negotiated down to the wire this week and passed overnight in order to avoid a government shutdown at midnight tonight. He wrote, "I'm considering a veto of the omnibus spending bill based on the fact that the 800,000-plus DACA recipients have been totally abandoned by the Democrats, not even mentioned in bill, and the border wall, which is desperately needed for our national defense, it is not fully funded." Joining us now for our Friday Politics Roundtable, Enrique Acevedo, a news anchor at Univision. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Rick Klein, ABC News political director. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
And a threat to veto the spending bill over DACA? Let's listen to Kellyanne Conway, the White House advisor on Fox News this morning. She said that Trump would sign the bill.
The president's priorities are being funded, and the Democrats shut down the government in December or January, I think it was, you'll recall. Mm-hmm. That's not happening again. I think that was a huge mistake.
And White House aides were reportedly planning a signing ceremony for the president. Rick, what happened?
Nobody in the White House could even figure it out. The president apparently was watching cable news, seeing it criticized, and decided to tweet out his potential veto threat. We know he's been meeting with officials behind closed doors and haven't had any clarification from the White House. To me, it just seems like he's stirring the pot, maybe trying to give a nod toward people in his own party who say this is a mistake. But we've seen some wild behavior from the president in the last few days, so I don't know anyone that's going to put any kind of betting odds on what the president wants to do. Make no mistake, though, if he vetoes this bill, it will mean a shutdown.
Okay. Enrique, though, fiscal conservatives are coming to the president's defense. Retiring Tennessee Senator Bob Corker tweeted that he'll bring the veto pen to Trump today because he thinks those spending increases without any corresponding cuts are grotesque. Your thoughts?
Well, I think there are parts of Congress that, you know, in a way agree with President Trump. You find the Hispanic caucus saying that, you know, the budget is not ideal because it funds part of the border wall. But I just want to remind everyone that it was President Trump who canceled DACA and who keeps hindering a DREAM Act by tying its useless border wall to the bill. So the notion that Trump is considering a veto of a spending bill based on the idea that DACA recipients have been abandoned by Democrats is, for lack of a better word, loco. I think it's crazy. Republicans, you know, control both houses of Congress, and still the president was not able to get the budget he wanted. That shows how bad the administration has been at negotiating, and I don't see how vetoing the bill can fix that.
Well, so we know that the president was the one who ended DACA. Rick, who's he talking to when he says it's the Democrats?
This is about political positioning for the fall, and I think he's trying to divide Democrats from parts of their base. A lot of folks in the Democratic Party not happy that there's no DACA deal as part of this, but Enrique's right. I mean, this is the president's doing, and he owns the ending of DACA if, in fact, people end up being deported as a result. I really think it's a sideshow, and I think that the real reasons for him potentially vetoing this bill, I don't think have anything to do with immigration. They have to do with his border wall, certainly, but not DACA. And I think it has to do with the fact that this is a budget buster, and you have conservatives in the party saying this is a huge mistake and abdication of fiscal responsibility.
And Enrique, are DACA recipients worried right now? I mean, what are they thinking?
They've been worried since last year when DACA was canceled, Jeremy. And now the courts have temporarily fixed the issue, but it's up to Congress to create a permanent solution, and President Trump is not helping achieving that.
Mm. Well, just one point back to you, Rick, about this being a budget buster, but of course it follows a trillion-dollar tax cut passed by the GOP. So I'm not quite sure, you know, when it comes to the midterms in November, like, how is that all going to play out in the minds of voters?
Well, their calculation is that deficits really don't matter as voting issues, that if the economy is strong and people feel good about the economy, then you move on from there. But it has been stunning to see the reversal among Republicans on the importance of fiscal responsibility. They didn't want to add a dime to the deficit when it was a Democratic president, and we're seeing many, many dimes piled on the debt when there's a Republican president.
Okay, let's talk about John Bolton. President Trump named former UN ambassador John Bolton to become his third national security advisor in just over a year. On MSNBC, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, said there couldn't be a worse choice.
This is someone who's likely to exaggerate the dangerous impulses of the president towards belligerence, his proclivity to act without thinking. John Bolton once suggested on Fox News that the Russian hack of the DNC was a false flag operation that had been conducted by the Obama administration.
Enrique Bolton is a hardliner on Iran and North Korea. He argues for using military force in contrast with what President Trump had talked about of being anti-foreign interventionist. What are you expecting? What do you think of this Bolton nomination?
He's also a hardliner on Mexico, Jeremy. So, you know, it feels like Trump is finally getting the team he wanted, a team that faces potential and actual conflicts. He has his hawks now in charge of foreign policy at a very delicate time in our interactions with North Korea and Iran, a conspiracy theorist as head of his legal team who can lead the charge against Mueller, and a guy who looks very good on TV, as Trump said, as head of his economic council just after starting a trade war with China. So I don't know what could go wrong.
Rick, who's the adult left in the room?
I guess it depends on your definition of adulthood in this case. The question of whether there are people still that can tell the president to his face that he's wrong, I think people look to General Mattis at the Defense Department as someone like that, maybe General Kelly to some extent. It is a difficult thing to discern right now, but I think Enrique is right. These are, as seen on TV, advisors. So they all have credentials in their own right, but a lot of it is affirming what the president wants to hear and doing it loudly on cable television. That seems to be a qualification for the job right now, and the president is fundamentally changing the way even he has done the job. By some accounts, people we've talked to, he's happier than ever in the job, doing it more the way he wanted it to do, calling out people who said, well, you can't ever do it that way, and freewheeling it, improvising, and bringing in people that are likely to reinforce his impulses.
So let me just correct me if I'm wrong, though, Rick, because it seems to me that with previous administrations, what we see is a sort of a mitigating effect in terms of who's serving in the administration once the months and years go by and the reality of governance sets in, right? But here we have the exact opposite happening. We have, as you were just saying, the president aligning himself or surrounding himself with people who are more likely to affirm his impulses and decisions rather than challenge him. I mean, how worrisome is that?
Well, look, his brand is disruption. Disruption is domination if you're Donald Trump. And he is trying to double down on that brand and find more disruptive forces, people that will tell him, yes, you can do that even though no one's ever done it. You can do that. You can threaten to veto that bill. You can say you're going to meet with Kim Jong-un just because you're saying it. You can say congratulations to Vladimir Putin. Look, he's the president, and he gets to surround himself by people he wants. There's no Senate confirmation for these positions, several of these positions that we're discussing. I think in terms of checking his impulses, you have other balances in the system and like the judicial branch, like the legislative branch, but the president is going to conduct the presidency the way he wants. I think he's made that abundantly clear.
Why? And Magna, I'm also worried ahead about the lack of diversity here. I'm not only talking about gender or race, but points of view. Mm-hmm. In the first presidential cycle, circle, there most people just agree with what President Trump says.
It's not a team of rivals, you're saying?
It's not.
Rick, why aren't there more Republicans who have spoken out against a lot of the things that President Trump is now doing? We haven't even talked really about tariffs. Why aren't more Republicans stepping up and fighting back, given the Connor Lamb election in Pennsylvania and the Doug Jones election? I mean, do they still think that Trump's got all the power for them when it comes to campaigns and elections?
Well, this is a fundamental point about this election. I still think both sides believe that they are right, and they believe that they have a winning message. And that's why you're not seeing an abandonment of President Trump. There's lots of Republicans who are very uncomfortable with what he's saying, what he's doing. They've made their own peace about that. Either they speak out publicly or they don't. They find ways to get to him through private communications or even through cable television hits. But more broadly, in terms of the argument they're going to take to the American people, I do not get a sense from Republicans in Washington that they think that they have a broken message. They feel like they have some flawed messengers, and they have challenges, but they're confident still, despite Alabama, despite the Pennsylvania race, that they have an argument that can at least hold Congress this fall.
Right, Enrique, what's your thought about that?
Well, you know, I think President Trump behaves in one way privately and in another publicly. And Republicans, like Rick was saying, have these interactions with him where he reassures them that things are going to be fine and their agenda is going to be accomplished. So I think there's a uneasiness about what's coming out of the White House at times, but mostly Republicans are comfortable with their message and they think they can get the election. I mean, at this point, if we thought about a president who was making gains in the fight against ISIS, who passed a tax reform, who's achieving all these goals, you would be in pretty good shape. Coming November, you have all these scandals that are eclipsing all those achievements. But I think Republicans want to focus on the positive side.
Rick, Parkland students led a gun control rally on the steps of the Capitol this morning ahead of the March for Our Lives tomorrow. What's the significance of this, do you think, and will it change votes in November?
I think this march is a culturally significant, generationally significant moment. It could be that people of this generation look back to it like another generation looks back on the civil rights moment, a moment where people woke up and got involved. I don't think it's going to have a legislative impact, but if this group of young people, and I've talked to some of them and some of the organizers and people involved, if they stay committed and this really changes the way that they view politics, it is a potential game changer. It could matter in the midterms and it could matter well beyond that. Not just about gun control, I think, but just about the idea of if engaging young people that have been written off for a long time. They're starting to get off the sidelines, and they are going to be very much heard this weekend.
So much there, and we didn't even get to Stormy Daniels or the others. Enrique Acevedo, anchor at Univision, and Rick Klein, ABC News political director, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Homelessness continues to be an issue that plagues the country, especially in major cities. The latest data from the Department of Housing and Urban Development shows Washington, D.C. has the highest number of homeless people per capita in the country, followed closely by Hawaii, New York, and California. WBUR's podcast Endless Thread looked at homelessness through the chatter about it on Reddit and stumbled onto a conversation called "Stop Giving Money to Panhandlers, Please." They found a man named Shane Coraya, someone who was homeless in New York City for a period of time and who bucks many of the common assumptions about members of the homeless population. Endless Thread's Ben Johnson has the story.
Shane lives in Washington Heights, near the very top of Manhattan Island above Harlem, near the A train. It's the longest train line in New York's subway system, and it has some significance in Shane's life. We'll get to that.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks so much for having us.
Shane's 29 years old, short dark hair, clean shaven. His apartment is tidy. He lives with a couple of roommates and a turtle named Little Dude.
I've had him since I was 14. Actually, fun fact, when I was on the subway, a couple of nights he was just in my pocket buttoned up.
Shane's family is from Guyana, but he was born in the Bronx, where his family lived in a brownstone near the projects. He went to Catholic school, St. Jerome. He has two older brothers and an older sister. But he's not exactly sure how old they are.
You know, I still don't know that. Like, grew up as a Jehovah's Witness, and we didn't celebrate birthdays. Preach the word of God, do memorial service, that's about it.
Shane thinks he was around 4 years old when his parents got a divorce. It was a bad one.
All of a sudden, we weren't spending nights in the house anymore. We were spending nights in hotels. My dad was upping his level of harassment against my mom.
Okay.
Really messed up stuff, like her brakes would get tampered with, and just the sense of safety really deteriorated.
Shane thinks he was about 10 when he and his mom go to live with his sister and her new husband in Washington State. There, they escape his dad's emotional and physical abuse, but new problems pop up. First, as Shane hits his early adolescence, a truth starts to reveal itself, a truth that makes his life as a very observant Jehovah's Witness kind of awkward. He starts to realize that he's gay. At first, he thinks he'll fix it with God's help. But eventually, the stress of being gay and a Jehovah's Witness leads him to do something unfortunate.
One night, my mom was home. She was scrapbooking in the living room. And I saw her, and I really wanted to tell her. But I didn't know what to say. So, you know, I took a bunch of her pills from the bathroom and just started popping them. And then I don't know what went through my mind, but I just got really scared. And so I went into the living room and very calmly. Uh-huh. I was like, "Mom, I just took a bunch of pills." And yeah.
Because Shane tells his mom what he's done, they get to the hospital in time. And shortly after this brush with death, Shane learns something that gives him hope. There are other gay people in the world.
Thank God for AOL and those free CDs, because, like, my mom was not going to pay for the internet. So, like, AOL kept me online. If it were not for access to an outside opinion, I would probably be a repressed Jehovah's Witness somewhere or dead. You know, first it was like realizing that there were other people like me, that there were even other gay Jehovah's Witnesses, like,
wow,
was flooring, you know?
What Shane finds online brings him to this decision.
I remember the night that I came out to my mom. Mm-hmm. I was actually hoping that she would, like, take me to the elders and, like, fix me. Wow. Like, I couldn't do it myself. And she looked at me and she said, "Why is it my children become my worst fears?"
At this point, Shane is around 13. His mom isn't really talking to him. He's being bullied at school. So he does the only thing he thinks he can do. He reaches out to the guy whose abuse sent him across the country in the first place. His dad, who says, "Come live with me in New York." Shane says yes.
The only things that I knew about my dad was, like, really bad stuff. Like, my entire adolescence was spent ensuring that there would be no, like,
contact.
Yeah.
When Shane moves in with his dad, he kind of starts a new life. He's no longer religious, and he decides to tell his dad the truth.
I told him that I was gay, and at first he was super cool with it. He was like, "You know, we will get through this together."
Right.
But I was like, no, I'm gay. Very quickly after that, that compassion started fading away. Mm.
Why?
I think he started realizing that I didn't want to change.
This environment leads to some pretty big fights between Shane and his dad. A few times the cops get called. Things generally escalate. Then comes Shane's 18th birthday.
You know, my dad comes home and he's like, "Are you still gay?" And I'm like, getting ready to go to dinner. He's like, "Yeah, Dad, I'm still gay, and I'm going out to dinner with my boyfriend." And so I go. My high school boyfriend at the time, you know, comes home with me. And I'm trying to open the door with my keys. They're not working.
Locks changed. Shane is on the street as a high school senior. Shane goes to stay with his boyfriend and his boyfriend's mom, but it's only temporary, and he starts going through the process of finding shelter.
It was like the worst scavenger hunt. Like, you just have to go from place to place, and every place has different requirements, and you don't know which one's ultimately going to give you shelter.
Eventually, Shane finds a homeless shelter in Brooklyn called Independence Inn.
My first night there, there's a closet. I still have a little dude with me, so I'm putting him in the closet. Underneath my pillow was a fork that had been, like, melded, like, the two outside tongs had been, like, pushed down to, like, create, like, a shiv. So I was like, great, where the hell am I?
Shane gets a job working the front desk at a hair salon in Manhattan. Then one day, Shane's late getting back to Independence Inn, and he misses curfew. They are real strict about curfew.
So I slept on the train. Went to school, went to work, still got to earn that paycheck hourly. There was only like 2 weeks left of the semester. And it was kind of just like every night trying to figure out like where to go, what to do.
Shane found solace in the things that were routine. His classes, for instance. But then he graduates. High school is officially over.
That was when I actually got really, really scared. Because all of a sudden, my day had time in it that I couldn't fill.
Remember when I said the A-train had a significance in Shane's life? Well, now the A-train is his bed. This is maybe his lowest point. 32 miles, stretching from the top of Manhattan through Brooklyn and out to Far Rockaway, Queens. This stretch gives homeless Shane the best chance for almost 2 hours of uninterrupted sleep before he gets kicked off at the end of the line and he has to wait to get back on and head the other way.
I just slept on the train until I needed to go to the first thing that I had to do. And that also starts interfering with work, because you don't want to be the dude with the turtle in your pocket who, like, ruined your coat because you used to just all over it, and, like, going to work in a rumpled suit because you have no place to put it. And that was when I actually started to feel homeless. And that's when I started telling my friends.
Here, Shane's story could have gone really downhill. It's easy for many to assume that the reason someone is on the street is that they can't get it together. But Shane had it together. And instead of totally falling apart, Shane becomes really self-sufficient. Eventually, his drive for independence and his hourly paycheck get Shane his own little room in a friend's apartment. He manages to put himself through college. Then he keeps going. He finds a way to go to law school, and he gets a law degree, because it was the court and law enforcement that brought order to the chaos of Shane's life growing up, when it came to protecting him and his mom from his dad's abuse, for instance. Today, Shane works for the Bronx District Attorney's Office, the same office that, years ago, brought domestic violence charges against his dad. One of the other things on Shane's impressive resume is his work for New York's Department of Homeless Services, something he did when he got back on his feet. There, he realized something.
One of the first women that I met, I was like, hey, I just want to share with you that I was homeless, so I understand what it is that you're going through. And she was like, oh, so you've got two kids. And I was like, nope.
Never mind.
Yeah, exactly. That's when I became a lot more compassionate toward my story just being one of many.
Still, Shane has a surprising answer to the question that started this whole story. Should you give money to panhandlers?
You know, if you're triaging the homeless population, the ones who don't really know how to even ask for help are the ones that I think need it the most. For people who actually go up to another person and ask them for money, I always state, you know, I don't carry cash because, and this might be its own form of anger, but it's kind of like, it was so hard for me to ask for anything. You know, I know that this will not be beneficial.
Shane's ability to rely on himself and a strength of character that formed despite growing up in a broken family led him out of the woods, off the A train, and into his Washington Heights apartment, where he has now lived for 6 years. He has his opinions, but he knows he's just one story out of many. His story is still going. He's not quite home yet. He's working on it.
I've been able to do the basics of home. But what I'm starting to understand is also necessary for the concept of home is like people that you can rely on and trust and feel with. And I'm not good with that yet. So I'm learning how to be vulnerable with other people. And I think that's when I'll really have a sense of home.
For Here and Now, I'm Ben Brock Johnson.
And for more on the podcast Endless Thread, go to hereandnow.org. President Trump's decision to appoint former UN Ambassador John Bolton to replace H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor is raising concern in some parts of the world. Bolton is known for hardline stances against North Korea and Iran, calling for military action against both. Joining us now, BBC defense and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus. He's in London. Jonathan, tell us more about how the world is reacting to this.
Well, some very predictable reactions and responses, I think. I mean, clearly, those countries who believe that they are well in with the Trump administration and that Mr. Trump is doing good things for them. Notable example, Israel. Officials there, ministers, have very much welcomed Mr. Bolton's appointment. Other countries who are, if you like, at an ideological divide with the United States are taking a very different view. Not surprisingly, the Iranians, for example, have described Mr. Bolton as a sponsor of terrorism. The North Koreans have reacted in the past very poorly and take a very dim view of Mr. Bolton. And interestingly, even in South Korea, senior parliamentarians have voiced some concern and worry over what Mr. Bolton's arrival in a key position now ahead of a historic, potentially, summit between the North Korean president and Mr. Trump, what that might portend for those talks.
This comes not long after the Secretary of State was fired, after the chief economic advisor left. There have been so many staffing decisions that have changed the dynamic in the White House. Does that change any of the uncertainty that has existed since President Trump came in about what his foreign policy is going to be like?
Well, at one level, it creates more uncertainty, not least the rapid changeover of personnel. Remember, this is the third national security advisor of the Trump administration in barely over a year. One assumes that Mr. Bolton will start unpicking the staff that General McMaster had put together and will try to put in his own people. So that leads to more uncertainty and disruption at a time when, of course, there is an awful lot of diplomatic work to do, not least on the preparations for this Korea summit. I suppose you could argue, contrary to that, that with the arrival of Mr. Bolton, with the nomination of Mike Pompeo for the post of Secretary of State, Mr. Trump is gathering around him more people who are like-minded in terms of their view of where American policy should be going. I think has to say that whilst Mr. Bolton has received, generally speaking, a very negative press in the liberal media, I've met Mr. Bolton in the past, he is undoubtedly a very strong ideologue, but he is also an extremely capable man, great experience in administrations in Washington, D.C., and that makes him quite a formidable figure. But I think viewed from outside the United States, I think the general malaise and sense of uncertainty and constant changes of personnel is just increased, and I think there is a lot of concern amongst Washington's allies, and indeed, I'm sure, a great deal of unease amongst many of Washington's potential enemies.
That's the BBC's defense and diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus in London. Jonathan, thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Fifteen years ago this week, President George W. Bush announced the start of the war in Iraq.
To all the men and women of the United States Armed Forces now in the Middle East, the peace of a troubled world and the hopes of an oppressed people now depend on you.
Our next guest was one of those men and women. Matt Ufford was a Marine lieutenant in charge of a tank platoon that was part of the initial invasion in March 2003. He writes about the experience in the New York Times and joins us now. Matt, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, Matt, let me just ask you, I mean, when you were getting ready to lead your Marines across the border into Iraq 15 years ago, did you ever imagine then that Americans would still be fighting there a decade and a half later?
Gosh, no. It's so hard to look back at that time to think about just a time when America wasn't at war. And the thing that sticks out to me 15 years later and the speech from George W. Bush really took me back to a hard scrabble camp in the northern sector of Kuwait where I listened to that speech. And I'm almost 40 years old now, and I'm one of the youngest veterans who joined a peacetime military. And yeah, I could not have imagined. We didn't know how long it would take to get to Baghdad or how long the fight would be, but it wasn't 15 years.
Well, I mean, in your piece in the New York Times, you write really beautifully about the days before you received the order to move in and to cross the border. I mean, what was that waiting period before the war like?
It was filled with extreme boredom. We had a couple weeks where we didn't have any electricity at night, when we were in a completely flat section of Kuwaiti desert with tents that held about 40 Marines. And there would regularly be sandstorms that blew the tents down in the middle of the night. We'd have to put on goggles and go outside and try to save them. There just weren't enough tasks to fill extremely long hours of the day, and it was just complete and utter eyeball-drying boredom.
Well, it's interesting, though, because you write, Matt, in your Times piece, you mentioned the flat desert, and you write that it was as flat as your courage.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
I was always someone who felt pretty self-assured, and when I spoke to my Marines before the war began, I found my voice, It was just quavering, cracking. I was filled with nothing short of sheer terror of not necessarily the actual mechanics of combat. That was something I was well trained in, but just this huge unknown that, you know, of the 80 plus Marines in my company, only one had ever been in combat in the original Desert Storm. And it was this great unknown, not just for me, but like everybody that I was serving with. Mm-hmm. So, and for me to have what I think of as an ordinarily confident voice speaking in front of people was suddenly just shaking uncontrollably.
I mean, what did you tell them? They were looking to you at that moment to provide some kind of vision or assurance, right?
The only thing that I could tell them in honesty was that it's okay to be scared because we were all new to it and we would all be there together. We could all just rely on our training. We were very, very well trained. That's one of the beauties of the peacetime military is that you have plenty of time for training. And so the actual, as I call it, the mechanics of formations, of pulling the trigger, identifying targets, all that came naturally once we rolled across the border. But in the moments leading up to it, when you don't have any actual action to do, your mind is filled with just all the possibilities in the world and things that you can't even imagine.
Hmm. Matt, I've got one more question for you, and yes. I have to ask it because every time I think about the fact that it has been 15 years, I think about the fact that it's cost the United States more than $2 trillion, that more than 4,500 members of the United States military lost their lives in Iraq. I also think about the hundreds of thousands, perhaps a million Iraqis, we don't exactly know the number, who also lost their lives. I mean, you were there. This was your battle. Looking back now, do you think it was worth it?
I can't look at it that way. To place that sort of weight on any one person's shoulders would be too much for me to bear.
I'm not saying that. I'm looking to you. I'm not holding you responsible. I want to be clear about that.
Of course not.
But I'm just thinking, like, you are someone who served, right? You have a view that you know 99% of other Americans do not have. So that's why I was just wondering, from your perspective, was it worth it?
Was it worth it? I mean, if you want to take a hard black and white look at it, no. I have good friends of those 4,500. Good friends of mine are frozen in time at age 23, age 24. And I have gone on to live 15 very happy years and have had the joys of becoming married and raising children. And that's a joy that my friends don't get. And that is expand that by the thousands and hundreds of thousands of lives that have cost that. Now, I can't look back and say, well, that wasn't worth it, because that is – it's too hard to say that this thing that I did that has lived so large my life was just an utter waste. It's too dark of an approach to life. And so I got an email from my old company commander after I wrote the piece in the New York Times. He's in Baghdad now working with the combined joint task force there. And he told me that, you know, 10 years ago he was in Baghdad in 2007 as well. And he says it's different now, that the Iraqis are fighting for themselves. They have a cause that they believe in. They do it their way. We're not trying to force them to do it our way. And he said that for the first time, he's hopeful. And that's what I have taken away from this, is that, you know, I can't look at those 15 years and just wring my hands because I'd go crazy.
Yeah.
But I can look forward and say that maybe we're finally turning the corner.
Well, Matt Ufford served with the Marines in Iraq at the beginning of the war in 2003. He's written very beautifully about that experience in the New York Times. We have a link to that at hereandnow.org. Matt, I really send my deepest gratitude to you for your service and for speaking with us today. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, organizers of the March for Our Lives are expecting 500,000 people in Washington tomorrow to protest mass shootings in schools. It's organized by the teens from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, where a former classmate shot and killed 17 students and staff. Youth Radio talked to three Parkland students about how their lives have changed and what it means to be activists now.
I can't say that I'm not changed permanently, because I am. I used to be the kind of person that would say, no, I can't go out. I'm sorry, I have a test tomorrow. I can't. But now I want to spend time with my friends, with my family before, you know, you might not have them next to you the next day. We love to be activists, but we also need to live as teenagers that we are, which I think is good for all of us. We need that sense of normalcy back in our lives.
Sometimes I will go to the memorial. Sometimes I will sit in my room and watch, like, YouTube or Netflix.
Some people are still closeted and grieving, which is perfectly okay. But we just wanted to make our voice heard, and we were prepared, and we were fine with being out there and in the open, and we were ready.
No one's ever going to forget about what happened.
Normalcy doesn't really exist anymore.
But even though the spotlight will not be on Parkland and MSD anymore, we will create another spotlight, and we will take the uproar.
Yeah, you know, if someone thinks mental health is an issue, then we need to do something about it. If someone thinks guns are an issue, we need to do something about it.
The way that we are seeing this as students is we're not moving on, we're moving forward. We're willing to compromise, find any solution in both of those spheres, because honestly, any change, any movement that we see that may be a step in the right direction, we support it fully.
The voices of Ariana Ortega, Gabe Glassman, and Alex Wind, students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Their story was produced by Youth Radio. You're listening to Here and Now.
A new documentary about comedian Gary Shandling comes out next week. Shandling, who died in 2016, was a groundbreaking comic with two innovative shows to his name, HBO's The Larry Sanders Show and Showtime's It's Gary Shandling Show. The documentary is called The Zen Diaries of Gary Shandling. It's produced by one of his admirers, the comedian or the comedy director Judd Apatow. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to discuss the legacy of Shandling. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So I remember Gary Shandling from The Larry Sanders Show on HBO, which was great back in the 90s. Let's listen to a clip here featuring Alec Baldwin.
Well, actually, Larry, you know, you and I have something in common.
Yes. Yes, we do. A lot of you probably don't know that Alec and I, Alec used to actually date my ex-wife, Francine.
No, I was referring to our charity work with multiple sclerosis.
I know. I know that, too.
Eric, how would you describe Shandling's sense of humor?
Well, I think you have to sort of separate his sense of humor as a stand-up comic and his sense of humor as a TV producer and TV creator. His sense of humor as a stand-up comic was that he was very polished, and he sort of came across as sort of this put-upon guy who was at the butt of every joke. But in his TV work, he also took aim at institutions. He satirized the conventions of the sitcom and the television industry in It's Gary Shandling Show for Showtime. And in his HBO show, The Larry Sanders Show, that was a parody of the backstabbing and all the egocentric behavior that, you know, surrounds a late-night talk right. show. And so you had him making himself the butt of the joke, but he was also taking on these big institutions like, you know, the TV sitcom or the late-night TV institution.
Now, Gary Shandling was also a Zen Buddhist. Did that influence his work, that aspect of his life?
Well, you know, one of the themes of the documentary is that nobody really knew Gary Shandling well, and people who knew him only knew parts of him. You know, he was constantly restless and searching for meaning in life and searching for a way that his work could communicate the meaning of life. And I think that is where you see his Zen beliefs kind of surface. And we even have a clip from the documentary where he talks about his spiritual journey a little bit. Let's check it out.
And my lifestyle's changed. I meditate now. I'm getting into self-realization. And in fact, I went to a bookstore yesterday and I said, do you have Zen in the Art of Archery? And I said, no, we don't have that. I said, well, do you have Frankl's Study on Existentialism? No, we don't have that. I said, well, then just give me a Hustler. That'll do.
So that's a bit from his stand-up comedy, but you get a sense of how he's referencing some of the studies that he's actually doing in his actual life. He was actually reading those books, but then he kind of turns it into a funny joke at the end.
Shandling mentored a generation of comics, including Judd Apatow. He's also praised by TV critics for deconstructing the form. What kind of legacy, creatively, did Chandling leave, do you think?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when you watch the documentary, for example, Apatow talks about how Chandling was his greatest mentor for, you know, decades. He was a risk taker and somebody who could find the funny in a joke. You know, people talk about people like Jerry Seinfeld, for example, being craftsmen. And so was Gary Chandling. He was a craftsman of comedy, and he taught these guys by hanging out with them and mentoring them and talking to them about comedy. Ultimately, that might be his biggest legacy because, unfortunately, the shows he created, I'm not sure if people are as aware of them as they should be, but I'd urge people to go out and watch the Larry Sanders Show, watch It's Gary Chandling Show, and see, you know, the way today's shows break the form, you know, people talking to the camera, all of that kind of stuff Gary Chandling pioneered in his shows.
I remember one of his final appearances before he passed away. He was on Real Time with Bill Maher, and he was absolutely hilarious. And it reminded me of how funny he was. What's your verdict, Eric, on the documentary?
You know, I do think this documentary does a good job of taking a look at his life. It's long. You know, it's 4.5 hours, I believe. And so there are times when it can feel self-indulgent. But Apatow had access to diaries that Gary Chandling wrote throughout his entire life. He had access to home movies and video footage. You know, sometimes the problem is that when somebody who's close to someone tries to do a biography of them, they're too close and they're not willing to talk about the warts. There's a part in the documentary where he talks to, you know, Chandling's ex-fiancee, who was a performer on the Larry Sanders Show. And when they broke up, he fired her off the show, and she sued him over that. And, you know, they had a legal battle that they eventually resolved, and they remained friends until right before he died. And so they avoid the pitfall of being too close to the subject and not talking about the negative parts of his life. It's just it's really long. And I think you kind of have to be a comedy nerd to get through it all. And I hope at some point they might cut some of it down, because there's a lot to Gary Chandling's life that fans of comedy would probably love to know. It just might be hard for them to sit through this much of a show on his life to get to the good parts.
It's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about the new documentary, The Zen Diaries of Gary Chandling. Thanks so much, Eric.
Always a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Robin Young is back on Monday. This is Here and Now.